Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Jack Rawson. Rawson is an associate professor and chair of the Department of Anthropology at Ithaca College. He has conducted archaeological research in Peru, Chile, and Argentina. And since 1999, he has been working on collaborative archaeology and community projects with the Cayuga and Onondaga Nations in central New York. Welcome to the show, Jack.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Now, was there anything in particular that steered you towards archaeology and anthropology as a career?
Maybe my mother didn't like it when I got dirty when I was a little kid, and I'm getting my revenge. No, I love the combination of outdoor physical activity and intellectual thinking at the same time, and I like finding things. So
it was kind of like a grown-up treasure hunt when you got into the biz, probably.
Right, we try to deny our identity as treasure hunters, but it's there.
Now, I obviously want to talk to you about your fascinating archaeological work with the Cayuga and Onondaga Nations. What is it that you have found? What is it that you can tell us about what you've discovered?
Well, I've worked on several sites. For several years, I worked on sites related to the Sullivan Campaign, when George Washington sent a third of the Continental Army here to burn 43 villages, scorched earth, genocide, probably the most important historical event of the Finger Lakes area. In the last few years, I've been working on something a little bit different, a site that is starting to give us tantalizing evidence of the origins of the Iroquois or Haudenosaunee Confederacy.
Wow. Literally a confederacy? Explain.
Well, the site is up near Aurora, near where Wells College is, and it dates to about AD 900 or 1000, and I've worked there the last three summers excavating with archaeological field schools. And we have some evidence of symbols and smoking pipes related to the Confederacy, especially the secret societies of the Confederacy. And these secret societies, which were medicine societies, were one mechanism of uniting formerly warring nations. Mm-hmm. And so they seem to indicate peacetime. This site was excavated in the 1930s, and it was supposed to have had a palisade indicating a wartime site, and we were unable to locate that. And there's also a lot of artistic decoration on pottery that indicates peacetime also. And, of course, the origins of the Confederacy is marked by what they call the Great Peace, the peacemaker, with Hiawatha and a woman, Jugansase, went from nation to nation, convincing them to bury the hatchet and stop fighting. And the Haudenosaunee have long maintained that their Confederacy is over 1,000 years old. But archaeologists have long maintained that it's a lot younger than that, somewhere between 400 and 500 years old. And so this work may, it's really early in the analysis, but it may be able to bring the oral histories in line with the archaeology, which is really important to me because I work with the native people. I'm one of the only archaeologists in this area whose work is approved by the clan mothers and chiefs. And I collaborate with them, they work with me on my projects, and I really want to do work that's interesting to them instead of some really obscure academic archaeology, which some people do.
To help them with the history and interpretation of the history, probably.
Yeah. I've seen them debate this in front of me, the clan mothers and chiefs, where one person will say, the archaeology is evil, they're all evil, and the other clan mother will say, well, who's going to give us our history back if we don't have an archaeologist who's on our side?
Oh, that's an interesting interpretation of things. Now, you said in some of your literature that you're interested in the reform movement within archaeology, known as the indigenous archaeology. To tell us where that stemmed from and what exactly it means.
Right. It's a movement to collaborate between archaeologists and native people, and to involve them and to power share with them, give them a say in what gets excavated and what doesn't, because the history of archaeology is very troubling to native people, excavating their cemeteries, excavating their sacred sites. The native people often don't even know who the archaeologists are who are excavating their stuff. The classic case was Frontenac Island, the only island on Cayuga Lake, where William Ritchie in 1947 excavated the entire cemetery there, about 300 individuals.
Oh my gosh.
Dispersed the materials all around. We're still trying to locate them. So one thing I do is I work on repatriation cases, getting the skeletons back out of museum basements into the hands of native people for reburial, which is a really controversial issue that has split archaeologists pretty much 50-50.
Mm-hmm. Well, you say you're one of the only archaeologists that's actually approved to be working with some of these tribes. What did you do? How did you get into their good graces?
Well, I got to know them just by getting to know them, and I did a lot, various projects. The big one is the Share Farm project, which I think you've heard about before, and this was a 70-acre organic farm mm-hmm. that we purchased, a small group of us purchased in 2001. We ran it for 5 years as an educational center and transferred it to the Cayuga Indian Nation in 2006. And then we... And there's other various other projects. For example, one of the nations had a cemetery, and the cemetery is so old it had both marked and unmarked burials. And they were hitting old burials when they were burying their loved ones that were unmarked. And we took ground-penetrating radar out there and mapped all the unmarked burials so that they would know where they could safely bury their loved ones. Mm-hmm. So the kinds of things that have really obvious benefit to folks. Mm-hmm. One other project we did was we hired, and this was with the Park School. You're talking about Diane Lynch, who was the dean of the Park School.
Yeah.
With her, we hired a Native American filmmaker, brought them up to Onondaga, and taught eighth graders how to use video equipment, and brought them to Ithaca College campus to learn editing equipment, and they made their own films. And mostly they were taping the stories of their elders.
Oh, how fascinating.
And what that does is it also gives these Native kids a chance to see a college campus and see, hey, I could do that. I could go to college because there's about a 50% dropout rate of high school of Native kids.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So various projects, and it's what I call expanded identity. Doing various projects so that my identity with the Native people is not that of just an archaeologist, but I'm a person who works with them on a whole variety of projects. Yeah, I dig up their stuff too, and maybe that makes that easier for them to think about.
Yeah, it seems to me like common sense that you wouldn't just take stuff away from an entire group of people and for yourself, but you'd work with them. With, you know, for interpretation, for educational purposes, for the purposes of mapping history.
Right. It gives something back, because I'm getting a career out of this.
Uh-huh.
And what are we giving back? I always have students all the time come to me and say, I want to interview a clan mother, I want to film a clan mother. And I say, what are you going to give back?
That's a good question. A real good question. Now, you said in your biography that you came to Ithaca College in the mid-1990s, and you were shocked at the racism leveled against Native American peoples. Has that changed at all? And tell us a little bit about your experience since then.
I think it has changed. And I think there's a lot of things. I think Cher can take some credit, not all of it. But as we ran the Cher Farm as an educational center, we'd see a sign come down here, a sign come down there. And you know the signs we're talking about. I don't have to get into that.
Yeah, yeah.
And I know that their membership has dwindled. And of course, part of that may be that the Cayuga land claim has been thrown out of the court. And there is an Onondaga land rights action that is in the court system right now, but that doesn't involve any land or money. That was just a lawsuit involving environmental cleanup of Onondaga Lake and the Onondaga homeland. So I think things get slowly better. I'm an optimist by nature,
uh-huh.
and I hope that by meeting people and by creating spaces like the festival that I work on the organizing committee of which was the Tutelo Festival, will now be the first people's festival that will be associated with Apple Fest next October.
Mm-hmm.
You create a space where Native people and non-Native people can meet and get to know each other. And as in any form of mistrust or racism, people getting to know each other is probably the best solution.
Oh, it is indeed. That's one of the reasons why I started this show. I wanted people to be able to get to know each other better in our communities. Now, I've often wondered about archaeology. How do you decide where you're going to start digging and looking? How do you do the research in regard to even where to set up your equipment? Tell us about that.
Right. Well, a lot of it is archival work and photographic work, and a lot of it is people who just come to you and say, I found something in my backyard, I found something here. Now, this site I was working on that was excavated in the 1930s, I understood it to have been totally destroyed in the 1930s. And this 93-year-old woman, Betty Pangborn, came out to the share farm when we were working one day, and she said, "You should go to that site, and you should go back there and excavate there." And I said, "Well, that site's been destroyed." And basically, I went out there to do a test excavation, basically get some folks off of my back because they've been bothering me so much. And then I learned that, indeed, there was a lot of site left, and it was very intact, and there was some very important research to do there.
Wow, that's amazing. Things we think are lost, and we better go look back at, right? Now, how do you know when you found something of value in some of these places, besides, you know, obvious things like skeletal remains and so on?
Which I don't go anywhere near. I don't go anywhere near skeletal remains. I excavate trash middens, which is their garbage, houses, domestic debris.
What do you do if you do find human remains?
I call in the clan mothers, yes, and it happens once in a while. It happened once to me here. And it was not a burial. It was a skeleton burned in a house from the Sullivan campaign.
Oh, wow.
And we called the clan mothers in, and we put it back to rest and to settle the spirits. They had their ceremonies. But I think there's a lot more information in people's garbage and houses than in their burials, and that those things were put down there for a reason to stay there, I think.
And what kinds of things? Can you tell us about some amazing things that you have found recently?
Well, one of the most amazing things about this site is this collection of smoking pipes, over 100 smoking pipes. And they represent masked faces, and there are cornhusk people who are the little people or spirits of the Iroquois Haudenosaunee world. And when we found them, I was a little afraid of them, and we brought them to the chiefs, and we actually brought them to a seer to have them looked at to make sure that there was nothing wrong with them. And it even took them quite a long time to give me permission to photograph them and show the photos to the public, which I have received permission to do. One of the things that is one of the central issues here is that this anti-Indian group that operates in this area practices historical revision, politically motivated historical revision. And what they do is they write on their website things like the Cayugas arrived here in the 1600s, they never had any permanent settlements, this was not their homeland, things like that. So my work in general in excavating a longhouse and finding their pottery and having these dates going back to the 900s shows that they were indeed here and they had a long, deep connection, and maybe that helps people understand why they feel so strongly about coming back to live in their homeland that they've been displaced from for 200 years.
Yeah, isn't that interesting how people try to diminish people's settlements on the land? Mm-hmm. It's, you know, for political purposes, as you said. Now, Native Americans have always had a different feeling for the land and for traditions. Are there a lot of Native Americans who wish you weren't digging at all? I mean,
there are some.
And exploring this as a white man.
Yes, and I think that luckily for me, I'm supported by the clan mothers and chiefs, who I talk to quite a bit, who want to see this continue, and there are always some people who don't. And if the clan mothers and chiefs, who are the leaders, really decided they didn't want me to do that, I would have to walk away and find something else to work on. And there's plenty of things to work on as far as archaeology goes. So I won't excavate anything that I don't have permission to do.
Now, you've also done some anthropological research in Hawaii. Tell us a little bit about that. I'm interested in that as well.
Well, we have a class, the Anthropological Experience in Hawaii, and every other December and January, we take students there. And we visit the archaeological sites, and we work with the Hawaiian activists who have a sovereignty movement. There's a group of people who have wanted to regain their independence and break away and feel that they've been used and abused as a vacation colony for a long time. But the most interesting thing for the students and for us as well, wherever we go, we took students up to Alaska as well to meet Native people, is that everywhere you go, the issues are the same. Native people trying to regain their sovereignty, and they're also trying to revitalize their culture and regain pride and practice of their culture. And so it seems like it's remarkably the same issues wherever you go. And we even traveled to Hawaii and Alaska with the Onondaga clan mother a couple of times to make those connections between Native people.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jack Rawson. He's an archaeologist from Ithaca College. Now, do you think archaeology, one of the best aspects of archaeology is bringing culture back to people and their own histories back to their doorsteps?
Yes, and it's important because the time depth is the only social science that has really deep time depth to it. And in this era, because of its implications for repatriation, getting those skeletons back, I keep coming back to this issue, but NAGPRA is the law that allows repatriation. It's the Native Americans Graves Protection and Repatriation Act of 1990. And a Native group has to prove affiliation. In other words, Cayugas can only get back things they can prove are Cayuga. Onondagas can only get back remains they prove are Onondaga. And it takes an archaeologist to do that. And I've even had to testify in cases before the NAGPRA review board on some of these issues to show that, yes, an archaeologist can really do that. So I think there's really practical issues. And also, I think it's really important for us to know our past. Too many Americans think that American history starts in 1492. And there's a lot of very fascinating history in the ground, and we don't have documents and archives to go with that history. The only way we have to get at it is archaeology.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've done presentations called The Land Speaks in Many Voices. I'm fascinated just by that term. Do you feel that the land speaks? And do you sometimes hear silence?
Sure, the land does speak, and I think that it's alive, and the native perspective on lands and sites is that it's a living thing, and I like that analogy a lot. Mm-hmm. In fact, I always tell my audiences that archaeology is like surgery on the ground. If you have to have surgery, you hope the doctor has a plan, and they're going to excavate your body as little as possible, and they're going to heal you afterwards. And that's how I look at an archaeological site. You have to you do surgery on it with care and love, as little as you need to get the information, and then you heal that land. It's backfilled and reseeded and put back the way it was afterwards.
That's a beautiful thought, actually. Now, we do live in a high-tech world. Has the high-tech world given you new tools in which to excavate that you can't use because it's so damaging? Do you still have to just get out there and dig?
Sometimes, yes. There's ground-penetrating radar and magnetometers, and there's non-invasive things. And you're right, the technology is unbelievable. I just went to the National Archaeology meetings, and every time I go to a big conference, I see new technology that I could have never even imagined. It looks like science fiction to me, handheld microscopes and 3D scanners, and it's always amazing to me. And one of the things that's new is small X-ray fluorescence machines that you can do the trace elements on pottery sherds and tell locally made pottery from traded-in pottery by shooting it with this little gun-like machine. And we're doing that with our pipes and our pot sherds right now to understand trade and understand, because, for example, if a pot has a different design, so one site, in all the compartments of the longhouse, you have Cayuga pottery. In one compartment, there's Seneca pottery. And by shooting it, we don't know. Is this locally made Seneca pottery, meaning a Seneca woman married into the village? Or is it pottery that was traded from the Senecas? And we can now tell that difference because of high technology analysis.
That's amazing.
That's amazing, just amazing to me, too.
But does it feel like it's going to take you away from the essence of what archaeology used to be, the getting dirty kind of thing that we started out with?
Not really. I don't think it will ever disappear. I think we have to save archaeological sites. Archaeological sites are disappearing at an alarming rate due to development and various things, natural forces as well, and even hobby collectors. And I hope we don't see the day where archaeological sites are gone, because they're non-renewable resources. They're not like trees. You can't grow new archaeological sites.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. I worry about that, too. We are taking over the land with our concrete dreams, right?
Right. Every site's a unique story.
Yeah, yeah. Now, in your note to me, you said that archaeology is the force that restores the true history and combats politically motivated historical revision. But in today's culture, a lot of people are not believing science and are not mm-hmm. believing archaeology and what we're finding. How do you talk to people about that?
Right, and I hear that a lot, and I also hear questions about my own objectivity as a scientist, since I'm so squarely in this collaboration with Native people. Really, it's about presenting your data. And if you present all your data completely, then you're free to interpret it any way you want. And anybody else is free to come out and say, I can interpret that data in a different way. So certainly we have that bridge between that. And I encourage my students as well to keep those really separated. You put out your data, here's our pottery, here's our stone tools, here's our plant remains. And then on the other hand, here's the story I think it tells. And anybody else is free to tell another story with it. So in that sense, you're free to believe or not believe, but at least everybody has the basic data.
Mm-hmm. And are you getting into the creationism versus science wars? Do you get any of that from your students?
I've been there. I went to the University of Kentucky, so I was in the middle of that. I used to teach evolution classes and with protesters outside my classroom.
Really? That was even quite a while ago, because it seems to have heated up in recent years.
That was a long time ago, when they had the scientific creationism issue, where they're trying to get the creationist textbooks into the high schools. That was the early 80s in Kentucky. And that challenge was survived, and it's a really, you could do a whole hour on that alone. It's such a complicated topic.
Yeah, it is. What sort of attributes do you want to instill in your students to make them good archaeologists? Do you have any rules of thumb for them?
Well, generally, very few of my students are going to be archaeologists. Mm. I have a wide range of students in all kinds of areas, and many teachers, for example, who are going to take archaeological knowledge and knowledge of the Haudenosaunee to the classrooms, because I also go into lots of classrooms. Mm-hmm. In New York, the education about Native people is pathetic, to tell you the truth. They have a little fourth grade unit, and then they don't ever hear much about it. In fact, in high schools, I ask them how many have ever heard of the Sullivan Campaign, and most students in this area have never heard of this monumental event.
That's amazing.
My few archaeologists, I preach honesty. Be honest with your data. Don't make something out of it that it's not. Patience in terms of care. So we're skill builders. So I have a full lab, and the students learn how to analyze artifacts as an undergraduate before they ever go on to grad school, which is fairly unusual.
Yeah. I also wanted to ask you about how working with the Native American people has changed you as a person. What have you learned just as a human being, because you've so absorbed this part of your work?
Well, certainly this enormous respect for archaeological sites and the environment and the incredible knowledge base that Native people have, that we might not call it scientific, but but in many ways it is scientific in terms of the rhythms of the environment. And their wisdom in many areas, for example, we're talking about what do we do with collections that we've accumulated over the years. And they are trying to figure out whether they want to rebury some of the collections, all the collections, have their own collection warehouse, but they don't want me to put them in New York State curation facilities anymore. Here's a story that may typify everything I've learned from Native people. One time I was talking with a clan mother, I said, oh, when I found the Peachtown site, which was one of the Sullivan sites, and she said, you didn't find any site. The site revealed itself to you because the time and place was right for it. Mm. Archaeologists don't find anything. They just have things revealed to them when things are ready to be revealed. So, for example, we're still looking for the Tutelo village that is somewhere in South Ithaca. And they're not concerned about that. They say, it will reveal itself when the time is right. The time's not yet right. And that tells a lot about humility and modesty, which is really important, because academics tend to feed their egos a lot. and I can be guilty of that, too, sometimes. And it reminds me to be modest and to remember the bigger purpose of why I do this research.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever thought about not teaching and just doing archaeological research?
I did that for several years before I came to Ithaca, I'm an archaeobotanist, so I study the plant remains from archaeological sites. But teaching is a really important part of my life, because what good is doing all this if you don't pass it along to somebody as well? And I think we can have such a huge impact by teaching. So, and I really treasure, for example, going into to the elementary schools and the high schools in this area for the same reason. Mm-hmm. And I'm an extrovert, too. So I spent those 3 years working in a lab and working on a microscope, and I'm not that introverted. So teaching is very extroverted, so it fits my personality, I think.
are there any new projects that you can tell us about that you'll be working on in the coming year or the coming couple of years that you've just begun?
Right now I have 100,000 artifacts from this site in my lab. So we're washing and sorting and trying to analyze it, because it's a really important site. And this is a really important question. If we can see an earlier Iroquois Confederacy than we thought existed or not, I have to dot every I and cross every T if I'm going to prove that and say that. And I have to be sure myself that I have that kind of evidence. And so that's where I am. And archaeologists spend 12 to 15 times the time in the lab as they do in the field anyway. We're known for digging in the dirt in the field. That's really fun stuff. But the lab is where the archaeology is really done.
And when you find some of the artifacts and so on from some of the Native American sites, do you have to ask the tribe and the mothers and so on whether you can reveal it or research it or even go more into it detail-wise?
Oh, yes. In fact, even taking photos to show to the public, I ask them about that, and sometimes it takes a while, especially with these smoking pipes. This was a particular issue. But they were broken, and they were put in the trash, and so even if they were once sacred objects, they were somehow used and desanctified and thrown in the trash, so there were no ultimate worries about them. But certainly I would respect that if somebody said, no, you can't do this, or you can't show this.
Mm-hmm. And do you think it's like you said, that you have been told that it will eventually reveal itself if it's meant to? Will we be able to reveal most of what we want to see in regard to these cultures, or are we developing too quickly? And you know, you're not even going to get permission to search.
Oh, I'm worried about development and loss of sites, and what the future generation of archaeologists will be doing, and if archaeology will exist in 50 years. I don't know. And all I can do is do the best work I can right now with the collection. And that's why I've excavated this collection. And before I excavate anything else, I need to do a really good job on the artifacts of this collection before I go digging anything else. And there is pressure on me, because people want to do field schools. And the school likes that. And the school makes money when I do field schools. And so they want me to do more field schools, but I have to stop digging until I catch up with what I've done and publish everything I've excavated, and then I can go forward with a clean slate. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, why dig it?
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me you have to have respect for what you find is probably the final word about that. Well, Jack Rawson, thank you so much for joining us. We have run out of time, and I really wish you well on future work. You're doing a great, great thing for all of us.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that, and I love your show.
Thank you. Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation in support of the Out of Bounds radio show, please contact our fiscal sponsor, the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes, at earts.org. That's earts.org. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.